Yes.
I understand your desire to talk to working class people about racism and sort of drawing on a rationale about how racism affects them in a negative way, but I don't think that that argument is an argument that is the most ethical way to go about talking to anybody about another form of oppression. Basing an argument on their self-interest, saying that they should be anti-racist based on self-interest rather than on a shared understanding of oppression. And I think that they could draw from their own experience to understand oppression in general, but if you're constantly basing it, if you're basing their solidarity with another group of people's oppression on their own self-interest, that doesn't then, that stops at racism and doesn't sort of get that logic. I mean, it's very particular to the relationship between race and class, rather than talking to working class people about oppression in general, which would open it up to an understanding of oppression in general, to gender oppression, to sexual orientation oppression, to all of those forms of oppression, rather than just sort of closing it off and making it sort of a very pragmatic argument that could then be flip-flopped in the other direction given other circumstances. So it just seems like I can see that being useful in terms of having sort of facts to back up your argument, but I wouldn't want to base my argument for why people should be against oppression in general and specifically racism on the particulars of their own interests.
Yeah, I disagree. As a community organizer for a year, and to get people to really get into their to issues, the issues were based on their own self-interest, and it was based on what they wanted to do in their own communities. So if I wanted to focus on racism and I wanted to just sort of get someone involved in it, I would want to get them personally involved in it. It would have to affect them personally in some sort of way. So, I mean, to hook someone into an issue like racism, then you can really deal with oppression. But me to just talk to work and be like, oppression, it almost doesn't, like, make sense. And I'm almost coming from, like, left field, I feel like.
Anyone else?
I think that you can appeal to somebody's own experience without appealing to their self-interest. I think you can explain to somebody how the same system is affecting people of color that is affecting them, and that it's part of the same system, without saying the reason why you should be supporting this other group of people is because it affects you. I mean, I think that doesn't lead. I think there's other ways to speak directly to somebody's experience. Am I making sense without talking
about?
You
can speak to someone's experience in many different ways, absolutely. But I think to get someone really like interested in doing it, I think it makes more sense to maybe talk about it within self-interest.
But then you've got.
Anyone else want to comment on this?
Yes.
No, it was just the flies.
Just the flies. Yes, sir.
There's no incompatibility between emphasizing to people the immorality and the connections to other kinds of immorality, and also pointing out that, and by the way, you're getting screwed by this system too. I mean, obviously it seems to me you don't want to base everything on just you're going to get a raise if you stop being racist, because then the response might be, hey, that genocide idea, that was a good one. Then we'll really have fewer workers, and there'll be a higher demand, and we'll really make some money. I mean, so, but there's no, you know, I don't see why this is being set up as, like, you got to either point out to people that racism's screwing them over, or put it in a moral framework, which I think it's actually pretty easy for people to see when you lay it out.
Even, yeah, if it's my fault for not emphasizing that, then I made a mistake. But certainly, first place, there's obviously no contradiction. No reason you can't say both. But however, I do believe that it is easier to make a moral appeal to people when you are speaking to something that is in their interest. It is easier for someone to believe something if it's in their interest. It is more difficult if it's against their interest, or if they think it's against their interest. I'm sorry that that's true. I'm sorry that people are like that. But I think that is true. Now, we should make both, of course. We make an ethical appeal. We make an ethical appeal to everybody. We can make an ethical appeal to the capitalists, to anybody. But to the extent that people believe that don't... It's easier to persuade people that they should do what's right if they benefit from it. Or to put it another way, as was said, if you can appeal to their experience, if they know to accept not just analogy, but to oppression is bad and you feel it, and here's how you feel it. This is what oppression means to you, and that's why you can see how it's bad for somebody else, and how it's easier for you to lessen the oppression on your back if you work with somebody else. Of course, it's easier to make it. We tend to make more of intellectual, abstract arguments because of who we are, because of our class, most of us, class basis. But we tend to see it more practically if you're trying to talk to poor people, working people. Yes?
I actually don't think that's all the time true. Like,
all the time, no.
Well, not even like, I wouldn't even make generalizations, because I've seen working class and poor people that, like, they make decisions based on, like, religious fundamentalism, such as my stepmother, that, like, are completely against their interests, that completely make no sense. It's just such a fervently held belief. And it's maybe it's that same thing, the way you say that, you know, poor people don't have those, they're more guided by practical whatnot that, I don't know where I was going with that. I guess that was the basic thing. I just wouldn't make those generalizations. That...
Okay.
I'm going to continue this self-interest conversation. I feel like self-interest isn't always based on tangible things. Like, I think her self-interest maybe was religion. So self-interest can be many different things depending on a person. In my, like, for instance, me, self-interest for me is, like, anarchism. You know what I mean? Like, that's why I'm an anarchist, and I put my energy into anarchism, because in my belief, I like anarchism, and I want that around me. So back to this whole ethics and morality thing, like, maybe we were probably saying the same thing, just defining self-interest in very different ways, maybe. Because I do see ethics and morality as part of people's self-interest in many different ways, and it might be different than their class interests, and it might be different than their sort of, like, sexual interests, sexual orientation interests, or race interests, or whatever.
JT, were you raising your hand?
No, I thought a lot of them also.
Yeah, but that's an interesting example. Now, most of the time, if the person, of course, wants to believe any kind of absurd religion, we don't care. They got a right to believe whatever they want. If that gets in the way, if it means supporting something reactionary, they become fervent anti-abortionists, for example, it's precisely the self-interest that is one thing we want to appeal to in order to break off this belief, right? That is, it's we'll use anything. But if somebody is, he or she is believing something that's against the interest of women, that's against the interest of working people, but she does it because she believes that's what God wants her, well, we'll try to appeal on what's good for people. We try to give an alternate morality. But we also, if we have self-interest on our side, even most narrow variety, we're going to try to use that too. And the fact is that really is true. You're right. Most people, after all, in fact, they accept the system. So in that sense, it's absolutely true. Most people will believe things that are against their self-interest, as well as against fundamental morality. And it's our job to use both, to appeal to the fundamental morality, the great concepts that have been taught by the teachers of humanity down through the ages, as well as the need for people to have a non-oppressive, non-exploitative society. Anyone want to say something on black liberation in particular, or it's all, I left no hook open?
I guess I still disagree. I mean, I think it's dangerous to appeal to people's pragmatic interests, particularly if you cannot, I mean, I think what you were talking about in terms of ethics being self-interest, that to me gets into a different realm. But when you're explaining to somebody that if you're leaving it at, in your example, that, you know, people in the South, workers in the South are more oppressed under a very racist society than the people in the North. If you then bring that out further to say, let's look at the, you know, the system of oppression, and let's look at how those two things happen in tandem and how they're coming from the same sort of idea and the same sort of logic, then that makes sense to me. It doesn't make sense to me if you're just leaving it at, well, let's fight against racism, because if we fight against racism, you'll end up, it should, because this is the pattern that we're seeing, create less oppressive circumstances for you as workers. So one is sort of bringing that out in a way that you're explaining the logic of something, and I don't think it has to be like wordy and inaccessible, and another you're just sort of leaving it at a very pragmatic interest. And I think that, I mean, I did a lot of work with homeless people in Oregon for years when the Oregon Citizens Alliance was doing anti-gay work, and it was, there's, appealing to pragmatism was useless in terms of homeless people and you know, the OCA talking about homosexuals taking their jobs and getting preferential. It worked much better to talk about ethics and talk about oppression. I wouldn't have, I mean, I just think that if you start using the pragmatic reasoning in certain realms, they don't always extend to other realms, and then you're stuck with a group of people whose ethics are based on pragmatism, and you can't appeal to them using the tools that they've developed their ethics on in other, for other struggles. I think that it could be dangerous if you don't bring it out into more of an ethical discussion and leave it pragmatic.
Well, I don't know why you assume we wouldn't bring it out. I mean, I could just...
The example that you gave, and I know that you've gone back on that, but you're saying it's you use both, but I don't think it's just sort of either or a little bit of this and a little bit of that. I think you would use one to bring out the other, in my opinion. Use the pragmatic to bring out an ethical reason, not just sort of throwing them both out there together.
Well, I think it would be mistaken to stick it as a... either way as a crude fashion. If workers are in a southern textile plant, are divided bitterly due to race, and you're trying to organize and form a union and call for higher wages, one could go to them and say to the white working people, racism is wrong. It's against Christianity. It's immoral. And just leave it at that. Or one could go and say, if you want higher wages, need to form a union. It's important to put aside racial hatreds. I suppose you could say, even though you hate the niggers, because you want better wages. Excuse me for using this language. Obviously, either one would be too mechanical. Nobody would organize either way. I'm saying, however, it's a lot easier get people to see that racism is wrong in the values of Christianity and U.S. democracy and so forth, not to speak of anarchism, are against racism if it also makes you stronger to form a union as in your self-interest in terms of making more money and living a better life. It's much harder, practically, if you're in a situation such as, let's say we were in South Africa, and you had to argue with white working people, it's better... Christianity is better, morality is better, racism is evil. And I say, no, it isn't, because it means that I have to give up my nice house. I have to give up my servants. I have to give up my guaranteed job. Well, they're really inferior. Look at the violence and crime, et cetera, et cetera. It's harder to break through in that. And that says you have nothing else you can do but use the moral argument. It's just a more difficult situation if you have to only use the moral argument. It's easier if you use them both, because ultimately they come together. Which situation it is depends. I don't know what you'd say in terms of the homeless people. You have to use, you know, there's no direct connection. In a situation like I'm talking about, there would be a connection. And I'm saying mostly in terms of most working people in this country, white working people, it is in their interest to oppose racism as well as fulfillment of the moral values that everybody's been taught as children. Any other points? We've been discussing nationalism today. I've made a kind of a critique of nationalism. Does anyone want to comment on that? Basically, anarchism doesn't have a very good record in terms of either black liberation specifically or in terms of national liberation in general. It's very little. Sometimes it's been a disaster. In the Spanish Civil War, the fact that the Spanish anarchists did not give support to national self-determination for the Moroccans, which was in Morocco, was where was the base of the fascist forces, the military and the many Moroccans fighting fascist side, proved to be disastrous. In the United States, there hasn't been any real only a beginning of an anarchist movement in the black community. Now, the small group, really about a handful of ex-Panthers who have been referred to today. But it is exciting how, if you read the internet emails and the internet, that there is an international movement that's anarchist, a movement throughout several countries in Africa, not just South Africa, where you might expect it, as well as South America. It's no longer simply a history, but there are anarchist groupings throughout countries of South America, as well as Asian countries. We had a speaker this weekend talking about Korea, but not just Korea, Indonesia, other countries, as well as Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. Anarchism has really become an international movement of people of many colors. And this should hopefully make it somewhat easier for anyway for us in the United States. No longer simply a white movement. This should make it somewhat easier for us here in the United States. Not automatically. It's not like we get credits. Someone hands us credits or something. But you know, I've had people say, well, the United States, you're this is a North American ideology. It doesn't affect us and other countries. You know, an email, I had a discussion with an Iranian, a religious Iranian, who said he was an anarchist. We discussed attitude towards religion. Yeah.
Oh, no, it's a discussion. Oh.
Can you give us a sense of some of, like, your background and where you're coming from and the work that you've done and why you're here talking about this today and just where you're coming from?
Well, all right.
That'd be useful for me to kind of contextualize this discussion.
Well, we've been working on this, me and my friends, for some years. I've been part of these ideas were coming from reading C.L.R. James and as well as Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. I suppose you want to talk about the background to this stuff of black liberation. James was at one point a Trotskyist, and some of his most important stuff, thinking, came out there in terms of black liberation. He later worked out himself to be a libertarian Marxist, but that's almost exactly where it's less interest in him, because he started believing that the solution was to Marxism's problems was to go back to Hegel, which in my opinion is exactly wrong. So I've been thinking about that and trying how it applies to the United States. You know, in terms of course, I work with black people and Hispanic people, and you want to see how that actually applies. And I often hear people talk as though theories as though they never worked with any black person. I don't know what, you know, how people interact, particularly the job site. You know, you work on a job and people, you can hate people. You can have all kinds of, you know, racial feelings about them, or just your feelings get hurt. And you got to go back every day and be with those people. Am I answering your question? You want more personal stuff or what?
Keep going.
People.
Just trying to get a sense of what kind of work you've done and what kind of stuff you've studied and where your interests have gone over, you know, over the years that have brought you to what you're doing now. And
I,
whatever you're willing to share and whatever you think would be relevant.
Okay. Well, is there any other questions? I don't know if this is directly.
We actually had an interesting talk here about a month and a half ago with Ashanti and Kai came up, and I'd never heard anything quite like it. I mean, a number of us were here. I mean, just the two of us. Three. About the different forms of nationalism, and they sort of went through all the different variations of nationalism and categorized them, and also, and talked about their own forms of nationalism and why it is that they still support nationalist people who are involved in nationalist movements. I don't know if somebody else can describe this better. And they, you know, consider themselves to have very different stances within that spectrum. But it was interesting, you know, coming from Ashanti, who's an anarchist and looking at anti-hierarchy in general, why it is that he chose to still affiliate himself with a certain form of nationalism.
What's that certain form?
Remember what I wrote in here. His is a, sort of the most libertarian form, but he was just sort of looking at the need for him not, that has been the power base for his people has been nationalist movements and a desire to support them and to be working, you know, not to turn his back on the people that helped him to become who he is and help black people gain power, but to work within those movements at broadening the critique and bringing the anti-statist, anti-hierarchical, anti-capitalist critique to them rather than sort of turning his back because of his disagreements on certain issues, which was interesting. And I shouldn't paraphrase him because, you know.
Yeah, Shanti still thinks of himself as a nationalist and an anarchist. And you're right, he interprets it. It comes coming out of a black nationalist, the Panther movement. He still regards himself in a certain sense as following that through at the same time without fighting for a new state as such. I'm not entirely clear how it all works out in his mind, but in a way it's his continuation of you know, previous struggle. Where we stand in terms of any kind of real mass upheavals, we don't know, partly because the black movement right now is so at such a kind of low ebb. And we think of, you know, leadership coming to somebody like Reverend Al Sharpton. It's, you know, between Reverend Sharpton and Farrakhan, you know, you're talking about really kind of very limited kind of people, kind of a movement, and the enormous potential that lies inside the black community and the black movement is, you know, far from being unleashed. Partly because, you know, because there were certain successes, the destruction of the Jim Crow in the South, the legal segregation, which was an enormous success, and to a lesser extent, the winning of various affirmative action stuff, and that resulted in a certain layer of the black community being able to get itself into middle class kind of areas. And at the same time, because of various defeats, the fact that most black people are still among the poorest in society. The destruction of the Panthers and other radicals by sheer violent repression has caused a quiescence in which nobody really is, you know, set up. But just as we're seeing a movement, right, the beginning of the movement here, the student movement, young white people mostly, there will be an upturn in the black community. There will be an outburst. The fact that we've now, after many years, the rebellion in the so-called riot in Cincinnati, where it's been, what, a decade, has been, you know, for any kind of thing like this, the last thing being the Los Angeles, and then a long gap between then and the last ones in the 70s, 80s, that this is a sign, I think, that, you know, there's going to be an explosion. There's going to be an outburst. And it's extremely important for anarchists. Obviously, we're not going to be leading the black community on this, but we have to be open to it, available to it, willing to work with people, and willing to, you know, go down into the community and be willing. When there are outbursts, we should be there, supporting it. Yes.
How do you support a movement that you don't support? Like, you support the people and their struggle for freedom, but you don't necessarily support their goal of what freedom is. I've been involved in a movement like that, where I've been in that situation, and I'm trying to find my way out of it because of that. Because I feel like I don't support their end goal at all.
Like what? Can you tell us?
Yeah, I've been involved in the Tibet movement for the last year.
What?
With the Free Tibet movement?
Uh-huh.
For the last year and a half.
Right.
Pretty heavily. And I don't at all support their end goal, which is, well, I mean, their end goal is independence for Tibet.
Right.
Self-determination, but, you know, they want the Dalai Lama to be their political and spiritual leader, and I'm like, well, obviously I'm not going to support that, but, like, how, but at the same time, they're, you know, it's obvious that they're in a really bad position right now, mm-hmm. You know, so how do you support them without
endorsing,
not supporting
right.
them?
Anyone want to
radical critiques are not rampant in the Tibet movement either. I've seen a couple.
Anyone want to comment on that? Yes?
I guess, I don't see a question like that being that different than a question of how does, one certain type of anarchist, like a green anarchist, support anarchist? Like, is that you recognize that you have certain theoretical divisions between you, but that there are commonalities that you share and that you want to, like, assist, and that you can show up for numbers at a rally. Like, sometimes little things like that, like, are really, really important and useful, and show that you have some sort of common interest, but that also, I think, even more importantly, open up a positive discourse as opposed to an attacking discourse. Like, if you can show someone that you support them on a certain level, they'll be more open to hearing your criticism of them on a different level, maybe at a later time.
Right, well, I mean, that's the thing, is that, like I said, I've been really involved in the movement for the last year and a half. And even now, like, I wouldn't feel comfortable calling out to the New York City Tibetans being like, hey, let's talk about what freedom is, what you're thinking freedom and independence is. What does Free Tibet mean? I wouldn't feel comfortable being the one calling it out and being, like, the only non-Tibetan there.
There's nobody, no other Tibetans who've seen potentially open to this.
Laden's cousin.
Yeah, Laden's cousin a bit. Jonghyun Norbu a bit, but even but not, I don't know, after.
The Tibetans are actually horrified by it. Yeah. I mean, he's quite radical he's sort of considered the Malcolm X of Tibet, and I thought he was really rad when he spoke, and all the Tibetan youth, we were probably with 100 Tibetan youth, were totally, like, they were scandalized. They couldn't believe what he was saying, that he was speaking something different than the Dalai Lama. It was pretty wild.
Hmm. All right, there are two things. One is, how do you personally or theoretically reconcile your positions? The other is, practically, how do you deal with it? You know, I have no idea how you can deal with it practically. You know, what the situation is in the Tibetan support movement. of course, on a different level, is, as you say, self-determination. They've got a right to independent nation, including they have a right to choose the Dalai Lama. You know, we can agree on that, even though we don't think they should be choosing the Dalai Lama.
Right.
You know, it's not arrogant of us. We have a right to our opinion. But it would be wrong of us to enforce this, to say, no, we're not going to support your right to independence unless you junk the Dalai Lama because we think so. On the other hand, it would be wrong of us to say, and a false kind of racism, really, false humility, to say, well, we're junking we personally are anarchists, but for you, you don't have to be an anarchist. It's similar. I've gotten an argument from the race traitor people who said it's wrong, the disputes in the black community, is wrong for us to express our opinion, for anarchists to express our opinion. If they should develop their own black anarchists, that's good. But if not, it's not for white people to intervene in the black community in any way, shape, or form. And you think about that, right? The Democratic Party, that can intervene in the black community, right? The Christian Church, that can intervene in the black community. All kinds of maniacs and nuts can speak in the black community. But we anarchists, if we white, we can't intervene in the white black community and say what we think, no matter how careful, how respectful, you know, we are. Well, that's simply wrong, and in fact, it's accepting, you know, a racist, really, kind of view. If we think we have, you know, may have to be very careful, respectful, and so forth, and really the best way is to find out what arguments are actually going on in the community, and usually we'll find, if people, best thing you find anarchists, but if you don't find anarchists, you'll find something, black women objecting to nationalists, chauvinism, for example. Find plenty of that. Or disputes between the nationalists and the integrationists. Well, that's there. Should we support the Democrats? Those disputes. Well, they're real disputes in which you can intervene and talk to, if you have a paper or journal or some way to intervene. But certainly the idea that we can't have an opinion is maybe absurd. Yes?
Well, I think you think maybe in that sort of circumstance where you have a group with a centralized leader or some sort of nationalism, whether rather than supporting, sort of being an ally of the people who are involved in that struggle and not of the struggle itself. So rather than supporting the agenda that we might regard to be top-down, supporting the people who are supporting that agenda, but supporting the empowerment of those individuals in a social way, you know, not in terms of supporting the politics, but supporting that those communities so that they can self-determine, they're more equipped to self-determine once they're, you know, achieve what they want to achieve. Might be one way of going about it.
Do you want to say something? We're all affected by the heat and the flies. Well, there are two things we want to get across. We want to get across, first, that we support the struggle, and secondly, that we don't like the leadership. And how we do it is a matter of, you know, formulation. The way I was taught when I was a Trotskyist was that you say, we support national self-determination, we support everything the nation, the right of that nation against the foreign imperialists. If tomorrow the United States invaded Cuba, we would support Cuba, including the Cuban government, against the United States military. But we support the Cuban people against the Cuban government and so forth. I think most anarchists would feel uncomfortable with a formulation like that, even though they might even agree with it. But they would probably prefer something with supporting the Cuban people, the Cuban nation, and we oppose the government. As long as we get these two aspects out. If there's nothing else, sorry it wasn't more exciting, then maybe we want to break up.
I think it is going to become like more of an issue, and it already is. I'm looking at the NEPAC statement on national liberation and then the Ruckus, and like I see these as kind of being two coastal poles on the issue, and the two organizations that are putting different things at the forefront of their analysis, although ironically it's like you said with the stone metaphor, they're using race to get to class in the Ruckus thing. But I think it is good. I think
there's probably more there if we formulate.
Yeah.
Maybe reading these or something would offer something up more.
The original NEFAC statement said, we don't support national liberation.
Yeah,
the current one, the last one, says we don't support the ideology of national liberation.
Yeah, that's
which is a big, important difference. That's a big improvement. I certainly would not have joined an organization if I thought it wouldn't let me support Palestinians against Israelis. You know? So it's... I think it could be improved, could be made clearer. But what does the Rucka statement say?
Says the organization, this proposed organization I want to form, should also support the principle of self-determination or the right for people to control their own life and destiny. Movements for self-determination have often assumed the politics of nationalism. Anarchists have traditionally rejected nationalism as a tool of oppression. We recognize that anti-statism and nationalism are often contradictory tendencies, since nationalism often supports the creation of nation-states. However, nationalism has also been a liberating force in world history, particularly in the struggle against colonialism. Thus, despite its contradictions...
Struggle against which?
Colonialism. Thus, despite its contradictions, nationalist struggles cannot be rejected out of hand by anti-authoritarian revolutionaries. The task is to develop anti-statist tendencies within nationalist movements, not to denounce the struggles of oppressed peoples because they assume a nationalist form.
Yeah, a lot of this depends on what you mean by nationalism.
Yeah.
You know, people's love of their country and their culture. In fact... we've been accused sometimes by some with extreme anti-nationalists of saying something similar to Lenin on national self-determination. But in fact, in a certain sense, we're more pro-nationalist in the sense that Lenin's idea was you give the point of giving national self-determination was that the oppressed nation would then say, gee, the oppressors, the former oppressors are no longer... racist, they're oppressive, and so forth, and therefore we can all merge. The aim was ultimately to everybody merge in one world society, one centralized world society where everyone speaks the same language, have the same culture, and so forth. Right. Whereas anarchists have traditionally been, we're decentralists as well as internationalists. And therefore we would treasure different national cultures and different homelands in certain ways, in spite of the various difficulties this might cause. So in that sense, we're more for, you know, respect for local nationalities. The problem is, it's true, the ideology of nationalism has been used to establish new states. It's not like it might, you know, it might. I mean, all over the world, they've been set up their own capitalist, their state capitalist regimes and nationalist regimes, and oppressed other nationalities. You know, talk to the Vietnamese Chinese boat people who fled Vietnam. You know, talk to the so-called fourth world of primitive, you know, so-called primitive tribal people who've been oppressed by various nationalities. So it's not a might involved, and it's a point that has to be made, I think, clearly if you're an anarchist, not just it's something we should get rid of our former, you know, opposition to nationalism. We have to be very clear why we hate. Oh, we hate these people. We hate these guys. Okay, thank you for coming.
Thank you.